The Tom Woods Show, episode 1859.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, creating an online course can be an excellent way of establishing yourself as an authority. It's also a great first product. And if you know what you're doing, it can generate you some real smackers. But how do you do it? Well, I have a teensy-weensy bit of experience with online courses, and I've put together some material that takes you through step-by-step exactly what to do and then how to market that course so people find out about it and buy it. Get these free resources at tomwoods.com/makecourses. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Where has the time gone? Here we are with the final episode of Gary Chartier Week. And in this episode, we're going to talk about friendship. And this is something Gary knows a lot about, not just because he has a lot of friends, but because friendship was the subject of his doctoral dissertation and also the subject of a forthcoming book. And we'll ask him a little bit about that he's working on right now. And there are a number of issues that I want to raise with regard to friendship. And we'll conclude with a brief discussion of politics and friendship. What is the role of politics in all this? And can a friendship survive political differences? It might seem obvious that it could, and to some people it might seem that there's no way that it can, and we'll wrestle with that a little bit, but that's really something you've got to think over for yourself. But we're going to give you some food for thought in today's episode, no doubt. So Gary, welcome back.
Hey, Tom.
Last episode of Gary Chartier Week, but that's okay. You can follow Gary, as we've said, and you can read his books and get a lot more of the kind of material we've been talking about. So we're talking about a topic that you've devoted a great deal of time to, including your own dissertation as well as a forthcoming book, and that is the subject of friendship. I love this topic. When growing up, I don't think I fully understood what a friend was. I think I thought of a friend in terms, you know, Aristotle has that classic typology of friendship, and I really think I thought of friendship as being a utilitarian relationship. You know, I have fun riding my bike with this person. You know, that's as far as it goes. And then you realize just how deep a friendship can go and how irreplaceable it is and how important it is to human life. So first of all, do you think that Aristotle's delineation of the several different kinds of friendship is helpful? Does it leave stuff out? What do you think about it?
Yeah, so every Western conversation about friendship begins with Aristotle's characterization of friendships as friendships of pleasure, utility, and virtue. So, you know, I think that obviously captures something we recognize. A great deal depends, of course, on how you cash it out, right, in a particular case. So if we think about the different factors that Aristotle refers to as not so much the focus of the friendship, but as the bond of the friendship, the thing that kind of keeps the friendship together, then I think it's very much on point, right? That in the case of the friendship of utility, I only stick around if I'm getting something out of the relationship, say of a practical extrinsic nature. In case of the friendship of pleasure, I stick around only if I'm enjoying myself. In the friendship of virtue, I stick around because of, you know, loyalty and commitment. There is something that's independent of my immediate preferences and so forth. Then I think that's exactly right. Now, I think there are other ways of reading the notion of friendship of virtue that probably don't seem to me quite on point, namely ways of reading that in accordance with which the friendship is, as it were, about virtue. And even if you take, as the Greeks will have, a more expansive conception of what virtue amounts to than probably we might think using the word in English today, it still seems to me that that's sort of priggish and not really reflective of our own experience. When I think about the deep, close friendships that I have, I certainly hope that we exhibit in relation to each other and learn in relation to each other various kinds of excellences of character, but it doesn't really seem there as if that's, as it were, what the relationship is about. So I think that's a kind of an important feature of those relationships. I have to treat you well, and in the course of treating you well and learning about how you're different from me, I think grow in character, and that's a great thing. And I can't sustain the relationship at all without certain, you know, minimum qualities of character. So character absolutely matters, but I'm just hesitant about conceptions of friendship that somehow treat that as the kind of central conscious objective that the friends have in mind. Some friends might, but I don't think that's always the case. So that's, I guess, the way I might want to start by qualifying Aristotle's psychology.
Well, I'm actually glad you said that, because obviously, you know, sometimes Aristotle is just dead on. And there are times like this where it doesn't entirely ring true, because of course, you know, the friendship of virtue, I understand the appeal of that, but I don't think I'm deficient, even though none of my friendships are quite that way, even though, of course, we are encouraging what's best in each other, but I don't think we would frame it that way. So how would you, Gary Chartier, describe what friendship is?
Well, so, you know, as with most important words, important concepts, we often encounter a lot of fuzziness, right? And so I don't want to claim that I'm tracking a Platonic universal and that somebody whose conception of friendship is different from mine is just for that reason wrongheaded. But, you know, so here's one way to think about the point I'd want to make if I were thinking about what was kind of constitutive of, at any rate, close friendship, right? So before I get to that, it's probably worth noting that in English, and I don't think this is necessarily true in all other languages, but I think in English, certainly American English, we find it very easy to use the word friend to describe, as it were, anybody who's not an enemy. And that can really dilute the meaning there. I remember a debate in the House of Commons. And I think this is typical, but I just have a particular one in mind in which one person is referring to the other MP who's the target of an about to be expressed disagreement as, you know, my right honorable friend. And I'm not at all convinced that that's really a helpful use of friend. But if we're talking about close friendship, and that's the sort that I guess I spend my time writing about, then maybe a way to think about this is to note a very common dichotomy that doesn't really seem right. So for English-speaking, you know, people thinking about friendship, and certainly especially, but I think not only English-speaking Christians, C.S. Lewis's little book, The Four Loves, has been very influential. And Lewis offers this dichotomy that, you know, lovers stand face to face and friends side by side. And I don't think that's right. And I think that seems to me to be a mistake. It might have, though I'm not confident that it always does, in fact, I'm pretty confident it doesn't, have something to do with what happens when a friendship comes into being, right? That is, it might be that some sort of common interest initially brings people together as friends. But of course, that will often enough be true of people, you know, in romantic relationships as well. So it's not really a stark contrast there. But I certainly think that for close friendships, the idea is that we move beyond, you know, whatever some occasioning circumstance or interest is, and move toward, you know, I think a fairly comprehensive interest in our mutual you know, connection. And so I think that a close friendship is certainly lots of other things that I try to talk about in the forthcoming book. But in particular, I think, you know, kind of close mutual knowing and a coordination of life matters. Now, you know, Aristotle says friends live together. I'm not really sure what he meant by that ultimately, and that maybe that's just a sign of my own lack of knowledge of classical era Athens, whether he really has in mind that they're sharing a household in some ideal sense. I'm not sure. I kind of doubt that. But I certainly think the idea that friends, you know, are engaged in a, you know, an ongoing sharing, both verbal and, as it were, kind of logistical, of life is important. To me, a friend is somebody certainly who, you know, cares about my welfare, but that, you know, wouldn't distinguish the friend from, you know, just some benevolent stranger. The friend knows me, cares about knowing me, wants to know me for, you know, the sake of knowing me, and really identifies in some significant degree. Again, not, I think, with the kind of intensity you would you'd have in a romantic relationship. The difference is often more of a degree than of kind. The friend identifies him or herself precisely as my friend and wants to share life with me.
All right. Now, one feature that is very important about friendship, of course, is that it involves particularity. I can't possibly be close friends or even friends in any meaningful sense with everyone in the world or everybody in my town even. So there is a particularity involved. And this, to some people, seems to be in conflict with, for example, the universalism of Christianity that won't discriminate between a friend and somebody on the other end of the globe. You're supposed to have the same universal feeling for them all, or even a liberal political order that speaks about universal human rights. The language is all universalism, and yet friendship deals in particularities. So how are these things compatible?
Yeah, and I think any thoughtful person who is, you know, immersed in certainly in the Christian tradition, as you say, who's immersed in kind of liberal politics, will in one way or another sense some tension there. And, you know, the best book probably still on friendship from a Christian perspective, certainly in the last, you know, few decades, maybe ever, you know, is probably Gil Mylander's little book, Friendship, A Study in Theological Ethics. And that tension is sort of at the root of everything he does in the book. And he, you know, as a good Lutheran, is quite sensitive to tension and really, I think, just kind of wants us to live in the tension and doesn't necessarily want to think that there's any straightforward way of resolving it. My own view is that we really should recognize that when we talk, whether in terms of Christian ethics or in terms of, you know, a kind of moral or political theory of universal, you know, human rights, that we recognize that if we are to affirm something like love of all people, that to do that is not to embrace the sort of impartialism in virtue of which we imagine for a moment that it is possible to treat everybody in the same way. I think there are senses of love in which we can reasonably say that we can expect ourselves and others to love universally, but I don't think that those involve anything like sort of conscious awareness of an active concern for every, you know, sentient in the universe. I mean, that's psychologically just impossible. And if we recognize that focused, deep, intimate, invested in kinds of relationships embody a particular kind of good, then to try to even try to have that sort of universal active concern and awareness would be simply to abandon the possibility of that kind of good entirely. Just as I think, again, my own take, at least on the Aristotelian Thomas tradition, there are various kinds of ways of flourishing, ways of fulfillment, basic human goods, whatever language you want to use, that require focused self-investment. And in the nature of the case, that kind of focused self-investment is incompatible with some sort of active universal concern. So, I mean, it seems to me, for instance, to talk in Christian terms, if we say that, you know, we understand, let's say, the golden rule that enjoins love your neighbor as yourself, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, as the root of the law. So we might think, well, you know, universal law is universal love, rather, is somehow, you know, the law. But then, of course, we understand this as sort of cashed out in the, say, the so-called second table of the law, Calvinist expression there, of course, for the, you know, the last six of the Ten Commandments, as Protestants would count them. You know, we have things like, you know, don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery. Those are things, you know, if that's the kind of basic or core expression, those sorts of negative constraints are key expressions, as I think they are, of universal love, then that, it seems to me, is something we can do without hesitation with respect to everybody on the planet. And that's pretty straightforward. I think when we start to move toward more active benevolence, active concern, whether for strangers or for enemies or for intimates, then we're talking about an increasingly kind of narrow focus as we move forward with particular kinds of relationships in mind. So my own view is that you certainly, again, without supposing that everybody listening here wants to embrace a Christian moral vision, if I'm going to speak out of that vision, what I'm inclined to say is we move from a kind of a vision of love as universal that I think can only be negative, can only involve negative prohibitions, and then we move toward active concern in increasingly focused ways, to use language that's been common, I think, over the centuries. We can talk about kind of concentric circles of focus. So that was maybe a long answer to a short question.
No, but it's a very important question. In your book manuscript that I read in preparation for this, I noted your reference to G.A. Cohen, I was going to say late Marxist, but he was deceased 12 years. I don't know when you stopped saying late. But anyway, G.A. Cohen said that, I think he was saying that when thinking about people in your political community, you should act toward them with the kind of instincts and moral intuitions with which you would act toward people on a camping trip. And you were saying that this is not something that really can be done. And moreover, that you don't go on a camping trip with just anyone. So right away, the very act of going on the camping trip involves a particular choosing of individuals. So I don't understand, I don't see why it's so important to take the concept of friendship and extend it to everybody within a political community or everybody all around the world. I don't understand why we can't just have two separate concepts. You know, one is a general feeling of goodwill toward people, you know, who have never harmed you. And another is friendship, which is something quite different. Doesn't that solve the problem? I mean, as a non-philosopher, it seems to me that's the way to deal with it.
Now, I don't know why so many people do want to extend the notion of friendship that broadly, because it does seem so deeply wrong-headed. And I'm inclined to think that what we very frequently see is precisely the kind of thing that we find Hayek complaining about in The Fatal Conceit. You know, the idea that we start out with a set of moral intuitions that are, you know, whether culturally or biologically formed, probably some combination, are formed in small, stable local groups, and then unthinkingly, we just kind of draw on those intuitions and think that they can be appropriately applied to, you know, kind of infinitely expanding concentric circles of relationship, when that's just not right, and that we really benefit, in fact, from having more impersonal relationships with others, not because there's anything bad about expanding the reach of our intimate contacts, but because when we operate in accordance with kind of general, reliable, impersonal norms in relation to others, we can all kind of be about our business. And, you know, we're not all trying to coordinate our activities. Each of us isn't trying to coordinate his or her activities with those of everybody else, right? And so it seems to me that, you know, Cohen offers a kind of secular version of this with his camping trip story in Why Not Socialism. But, you know, I certainly think we encounter this in, you know, in religious contexts. And indeed, you know, one distinguished scholar of friendship, from whom I requested a blurb for this book, finally decided not to give me one, in part, I think, because of some discomfort with the fact that I just didn't like this idea of extending friendship out indefinitely. Hmm. You know, if somebody wants to use the word friendship that broadly, then I guess what I'm inclined to say is, well, go ahead and use the word, as long as you understand that there really is a very substantial difference between you know, close friendship and the relationship that I have with a stranger who, you know, even I might grant is a potential friend under the right circumstances. And so if I'm not going to use the word friend to mark that distinction, I need some other way of marking the distinction because it's a real distinction, you know?
Right, exactly. Now, I read in particular the chapter on politics in your manuscript.
Yeah.
So let's say a little something about that. Now, it was something like 70 pages, so it's not fair for me to say, go ahead and summarize that chapter. But what I would like to have you do is explain to people how it's possible that there could be a connection between these two things. Because in a way, I might, in a Sam Konkin sense, conceive of friendship as being the very opposite of politics, because it doesn't involve the use of coercion. It doesn't involve the presumption that occurs a lot of times in modern social democratic politics that what's yours is mine and what's mine is yours and we'll dispose of it in the course of public discourse. It seems like friendship is a way of avoiding, it's the opposite of the political sphere in the sense that in the political sphere, we take differences that we have and we weaponize them against each other. So what is the relationship then? How are they connected?
So I found myself initially interested in this question, not because I had ever thought they were connected, but because I discovered that connecting them seemed to be kind of a popular pastime in the tradition.
Okay.
Right? So I noticed that Aristotle and Plato and Cicero all talked about friendship as politically significant, and Aristotle probably the most extensively. And so, what I realized here was that seems to me for Aristotle, the idea probably would have been something like this. So I'm not a classicist, and classicists who are listening here may find what I say in one way or another wrong-headed, but it seems like something like the following is going on. On the one hand, there's the conviction that participation in the public life, and public life here, you know, really means, I think, kind of the operation of a kind of microstate. The public life of the city-state is really the ultimate expression of humanness. And on the other hand, in a small population with an even smaller group of those entitled to participate politically, namely free adult males, it really does become possible for that activity of political participation to be influenced significantly by participation in a network of friends. And so Aristotle, famously says, friendship holds states together. And I suppose on one level, he may have in mind the idea that there is a sort of mutual affection among members of a city-state population. But I think he also does have in mind, in addition, the idea that, closer friends really do precisely as participants in friendship groups probably influence the politics of a city-state. So that's a very different picture of what political life looks like than anything we experience, because the political units that we're part of are so much bigger, than anything that Aristotle would have experienced. And of course, because most of us certainly don't have the view that human fulfillment is first and foremost a matter of political involvement. I think for many of us, even if we're quite interested in some political questions, we really would be quite happy to have a world in which there was less need, rather than more, right, for involvement in addressing political questions. So I start, with the recognition that our world's very different from Aristotle's, and just ask, well, is there a way in which that classical picture of friendship turns out to be relevant politically despite the real changes here? And so, as you suggest, that chapter is a very long one, and I just try to explore a number of different possibilities. For instance, the G.A. Cohen example that you highlighted earlier, do we want to think about the political community of any size as a community of friends? No, I don't think we do. So I try to explain what seems to me to be lacking there in something like the terms we've already talked about. But it does seem to me that if we imagine a kind of downsizing in one way or another political institutions, then maybe the friendship group becomes more important. And so I start by talking about the way in which Hannah Arendt and some other people have pointed out the importance of kind of small, local, either geographic or institutional councils as a basis for political institutions. These aren't sadly anti-statists, but at least they are, as it were, micro-statists. And so I start talking about what they have in mind and then suggest that, but if we move on to a genuinely stateless society where we have political institutions that are, that are non-territorial, that are, dispute resolution bodies and so forth, that are going to cross-cut geography and cross-cut other kinds of barriers. Maybe we as Marxian anarchists can see ways in which those sorts of institutions provide new opportunities for friendship to find some interesting sorts of political expression, because we are kind of maybe shifting back toward something that in some important ways, though obviously not in others, maybe resembles what Aristotle has in mind. But then I want to end up that chapter, and this is actually what prompted me originally to suggest that we talk about this, with what seems to me the most important thing right now, not so much speculation on, how much friends would want to be involved in their local dispute resolution agencies, but rather with the question of how, since this is a theological book, I'm interested in the question of political idolatry and the way in which, as it seems to me, in a lot of contemporary social contexts, fundamentally politics is treated as a kind of substitute religion, and political disagreement, therefore, as a kind of heresy, and political disputes then become really ratcheted up, intense, dramatic, and marked by a level of vitriol and rejection that I think doesn't make for a good life for anybody. And so I really conclude the chapter by trying to think about that phenomenon.
Right. And I'm, of course, very interested in that also. It's interesting that, although I'm quite certain, because I know of examples, that there are people, let's say, who belong to different Christian denominations and who believe in them very, very strongly, who, let's say, if one of their friends converts away to another denomination, it would be hard for them to stay friends over that. But but generally, religious differences seem to be nowhere near the divisive features of friendships that politics now seems to become, so that there are certain kinds of disagreements you can't have within the context of a friendship. It has to burst the friendship asunder. There's not as much on this in your chapter as, I mean, I'm sure you could write a chapter on just this consideration. And you do try to go through what's going on here. You say that you talk about the impulse to punish. Is that the impulse to punish is deeply destructive? And then you also talk about the desire to achieve purity by avoiding contact with putatively impure people. Both of those things obviously are very harmful. But yet, let me play devil's advocate here, because surely it's possible for me to hold positions that are so grotesque that you couldn't be my friend. So isn't political disagreement a mere extension of that commonplace?
Well, so I guess what I'd want to, I think I'm, at least for purposes of this conversation, I think I'm going to dig in my heels.
Oh, good. Okay. I like that.
Yeah. So I want to say, if, let's say, you not only hold this grotesque position, but you're in a role that enables you to do something about that, and precisely because of our connection, I'm in a position, let's say, to try to impede that, right? That then certainly might lead to a permanent rupture. What I wouldn't want to do, however, would be to pretend that if you hold some, just obscene position in the way that people, take positions at bars, I'm just not sure why I should regard that as somehow decisive as regards our friendship. As if you're just mouthing off and you're not really in a position to have any genuine impact, I'm not prepared to say in principle that anything you just say in the abstract should keep me from being your friend. If you then are in a position to do something and my deliberate attempt to stop you from doing that gets in the way of our friendship, that's another matter. But if you're really just popping off, then I want to say you're really just popping off. And I think a lot of what we see in political disagreements is so, to use your word in a different context, is so grotesque precisely because it involves people who are in no position to do anything about whatever is going on in the world, getting profoundly upset with each other as if their disagreements actually were responsible for whatever bad feature of the world they're observing.
Yeah, now that's an interesting way to think about it, because one of us may, I mean, I suppose the sort of conversation you and I might have wouldn't go this way, but one of us may really love a politician and the other one doesn't love that politician, really despises that politician. But my loving the person and you're not loving the person has no effect on anything. Washington, D.C. continues on regardless of the feelings of Tom Woods and Gary Chartier. That is a feature of the world. There's nothing we can do about it. And so I hear that we maybe are, if I may put it less charitably, we're elevating our own importance by making these kinds of disagreements into friendship-ending phenomena. Now, on the other hand, we are living through a time right now because of the COVID-19 problem, where there have been a lot of friendships that have ended because, and I have so much anecdotal evidence about this that I can't say that it's just confined to a few cases, just given that my inbox is filled with people writing to me about it, but people who say, well, because you're living a certain way, I just can't be friends with you anymore because I think it shows a selfishness on your part and I don't want to be friends with a selfish person. And I've struggled with this because I think the idea of politics poisoning everything is just so bad. It's not like it's bad enough we have to deal with the political class, period. But then it starts bleeding over into our friendships. So I have tried to resist that. And yet I myself have actually wondered out loud, Gary, whether it's possible for me just to be close friends with somebody who takes a very strong position against my own in this matter, because I think it's so fundamental to the question of human flourishing that I feel like if we don't even understand the path to human flourishing, how can we be friends?
Well, I don't have any desire, obviously, to try to ride herd on your friendships. And so please don't hear me as a kind of scold. But it does strike me that, you know, we have, I think, profound disagreements about human flourishing in a whole range of contexts. And I would say it's one thing, again, if the so here's a way we can imagine the disagreement being a problem. Again, I think here, with respect to, you know, at least policy disagreements with regard to dealing with COVID-19, again, our ability to influence those is as limited as in any other political context. But we can imagine a case in which, you know, I simply can't let go of the disagreement and I'm constantly bombarding you with criticism and just making it impossible for us to have, you know, an ordinary kind of interaction. And in that case, certainly might be understandable that, you know, that you'd back away from the friendship. The other thing I guess I would say, though, is that even if we have perhaps some fairly profound disagreements about human flourishing, as I try to suggest in an earlier chapter, whatever other disagreements there are, we probably don't have something that's a recognizable friendship without certain kinds of virtues in play, right? I mean, if I can't be, you know, let us say, loyal and respectful of your otherness, even while welcoming closeness, and, you know, just a number of things we can talk about there, then we don't have a friendship at all. Now, it's worth asking whether the virtues that we develop in that context spill over into other aspects of our lives and whether that's true or not, whether there is a kind of unity of virtue is, of course, another and more complex matter. But, you know, we do have to agree on at least some aspects of human flourishing just to be friends at all, because we won't be able to behave in relation to each other in a way that is recognizably that of being friends. And so I guess I can disrupt that by, again, just constantly attacking you. And while you don't, I suppose, have to say, you know, please never darken my door again, you can certainly, I think, quite reasonably say, I'm not interested in being attacked every time I talk to you. I'm gonna really have
right.
to back away here, you know.
Yeah. Well, first of all, two things as we start to wrap up here. Number one, tell people the name of your forthcoming book whose manuscript I just read.
Yeah, the book is called Understanding Friendship, A Theological and Philosophical Inquiry, and it's due out from Fortress Press, a great Protestant theological publisher, probably in January, it looks like, of 2022.
Okay, all right, that's very good. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, I want to say that I hope this week of episodes has been helpful and interesting for folks listening, and also is maybe an example to folks, because although, you know, Gary and I want the same outcomes, you know, we sometimes travel in somewhat different circles,
sure.
although we're both very good friends with David Gordon, because there, let's just say, I don't need to write a book about the benefits of the of friendship with David Gordon. It's just so many different levels. But the fact that Gary and I had five of very friendly and interesting and productive conversations this week, well, let that be an example to all the rest of you folks, okay, that we can do this. We can be human beings toward each other, listen, hear each other out, and make intellectual progress. So if you're interested in more of what Gary has to say, of course, all the show notes pages for this week will have valuable links for you. So that's tomwoods.com/1855 all the way through today's, which is tomwoods.com/1859, as well as garychartier.net. So Gary, thank you for the investment of time you put into Gary Chartier Week. We couldn't have done Gary Chartier Week without you.
Good to know.
Thanks, Gary.
Bye-bye, Tom.
All right, everybody, that is going to do it for this week. I have thoroughly enjoyed Gary Chartier Week, as I hope you have. Next week, the very first episode will be with the heroic Catherine Hewig of Ohio, who's done excellent work on COVID data and interpreting it and explaining it, making sense of it, getting to the bottom of it, telling the truth about it, including a recent testimony at the State House that was absolutely outstanding. So I cannot wait for my conversation with her. So that's coming up on Monday. So if you like and appreciate what's going on around here at the Old Tom Woods Show, you got a lot of goodies waiting for you as a supporter of the show over at supportinglisteners.com. I'm not kidding you. When you look at all the goodies, you just are going to be like a kid in a candy store. So check it out at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.